My guest today on Emerge is Melissa Michaels. Melissa guides individuals and communities through major life transitions. As a soul midwife and mentor to emerging leaders around the world, she has created Surfing the Creative, a rite of passage process that links somatics, youth development, and peace building. Her recently released book, Youth on Fire, Birthing a Generation of Embodied Global Leaders, tells the story of this life-changing work as it has unfolded in diverse settings, ranging from inner-city schools to college campuses and from refugee settlements to the United Nations. Melissa is also the founder of Golden Bridge, a nonprofit organization dedicated to our collective renewal through the liberation of the creative spirit. She is a first-generation teacher of the five rhythms and a registered somatic movement educator and therapist. Her doctorate in education, leadership, and change is from the Fielding Graduate University. She has also held a postdoctoral fellowship at Fielding's Institute of Social Innovation. Whether she is tending to individuals transitioning from one life cycle to another, or to communities in the midst of major change, Melissa dedicates her life to dancing along the edges and guiding others as they do the same. Her work supports our collective renewal through the liberation of the creative spirit. So, hi, Melissa. Welcome to Emerge.
Thank you, Daniel. It is a joy to be here, and I look forward to our conversation.
Me too. And thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy life to join me here and to share your message with my audience. It means a lot to me, and I hope it will mean a lot to the people listening.
Well, and I suspect I'm going to learn too, so I'm excited just to be with you.
Wonderful. Okay, so let's jump in with my first question, which is really just a little bit kind of get to know you, but I'm curious, how did you come to do the work that you do? You know, your life's work, I was reading up about you, doing research on you. Your life's work has such a long and beautiful arc, but I'm curious what your initiation into healing looked like. What happened when you first heard the call?
Well, I think like a photograph in the dark room, as one of my students once said about this work. My colors have been coming into clarity and focus slowly over time. It wasn't like one day I got everything and here we are. It's been a process of organic emergence with many key pivotal points along the way. And, you know, the big story that I tell had something to do with being at that very pregnant age of 21 years old. I had just finished undergraduate school when I gotten my degree in architecture, and I had gone to India to build buildings for the Tamil people. And I found myself in an architecture studio with a bunch of Indian, amazingly brilliant humans. And I was like, who am I to be thinking about spaces for people? I have no idea who they are. And so I hightailed it out of there and said, I'm going to find out what I can about these people. And I had already begun to be steeped in many cultures, but at that time, something about Hinduism and Sri Aurobindo and the mother was waking me up. So I wasn't totally unfamiliar, but I ended up working with children in the village of Kotakarai in South India, just outside of Auroville at the time. And I had a very deep and profound epiphany while I was out there. I had been a very disembodied, enraged, drug dealing teenager and young adult. And all of a sudden I was standing before these human beings and the only language we could speak was what I could communicate through my body. And so the journey home to myself to this body really officially began on the on those red soils of South India, where I just started moving my body. And as I say, you know, I started acting out in a whole new way. And for me, it was a moment of profound liberation because I felt so great inside to be using my body, and so humbled in the face of these bright-eyed, open souls who actually were hungry for something I had to bring to them. And the soul hunger that I felt within myself was being satiated in the connection. And at that time, I had just one day while I was alone under a banyan tree teaching whatever number, lots of young people, children. This voice said to me, "Melissa, the children of the world are calling." And that was not unfamiliar to me per se, and I'll explain that. But what was said was, "The children of the world are calling, and movement is your universal language." And something in me just, you know, it's like I wept from the core of my being. And I didn't really know what that meant, of course. And like any good rite of passage, you have an aha, and then one has to decode the message. It could be a bird flying over you at on a mountaintop doing a solo. But in this case, it was this voice and the reflection of this schoolyard of these children. And a lot of things happened, and I came back to the United States and actually got pregnant right away with my firstborn, and which is also part of how this work has grown, and I'll speak to that. But very soon thereafter, I was with my daughter, and I was riding my bicycle through a back alley in New Mexico and feeling very overwhelmed. I was still quite young, feeling very overwhelmed with the responsibility of this human. And I sort of called out, "Who is going to help me raise this child?" I was a single mom. And there were these young people sitting like out in the alley and smoking whatever. And I just had sort of the second part of that epiphany, which was, "You will raise the children that will help you raise the children." And it was just a call, you know, it was just something due to who I was at that time with so much unresolved trauma. And also just sort of the soulful way I rolled, I was available to receive clear guidance. And I was in enough pain within myself to take it very seriously. So I was like, "Okay, that sounds great. I just want to go back to Oroville, to South India, actually." And I kept getting, "No, you're going to build that here." And year after year, I would have dreams of going down this road, trying to get back to where I was working with those children, and the dream would go black and blank. And I came to see after a few decades of this, that actually I had done just that. And that children who actually grew up in that village ended up coming over here as young adults and being part of my dance-based rites of passage programming. And so there was just this exquisite full circle. And now they're back there running programs for children in that very same village and neighboring ones too.
I did not know so that part of it. That's amazing. That is amazing.
Yeah. It's yeah. So, so that was one of the key threads of my own understanding of what my path was to be. I can say more, but I'll pause for a second.
And okay, there's so many different directions we could go there. I guess it sounds like though there's more that you want to say. What else is alive for you now in that story?
Great, thank you, Daniel. I the question of what really got me on my path? What were the initiations? What were the key turning points? There are the big initiations, like the one I spoke about, and there were others. I was a young woman who'd grown up with a certain kind of privilege. I always walked between the worlds. My father was born in Russia, raised in Mexico. I grew up in Pittsburgh. And in my childhood, we would spend a great deal of time on the border, the Texas-Mexico border. And I had a very deep early on experience of the inequities on this planet as we would drive across the border to be with my grandparents. And I would see these children living in cardboard boxes. And I was like, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. And I was young and I was just like, absolutely not okay. And I knew that. And I would like find ways to get myself into contact with what these communities was, which were the Kickapoo Indians. And I'm not sure that's mm-hmm. actually the correct name for how they like to self-identify. But at the time, that was my understanding of who these people were. And so I would go and I would interface and have experiences that were both, you know, sitting at a table full of abundance in every way and many cultures gathered to feast. And then right out the window was this whole other reality happening. And so that stirring in my soul was young. It was early. I was awake to it. Something was not okay. And that never went away. And there were a number of other things that happened to me throughout my childhood and adolescence that disturbed me greatly. And I somehow, even with all the smoking and sexing and numbing through any number of things, could not shut it down. Thank goodness, really. And at a certain point, I realized that all this self-medicating, of course, I didn't have that language, was a distraction, and that my sanity and my soul were found by leaning into these places of discomfort, both in terms of what was happening outside of me and what was happening inside of me. And so I think that there's a deep teaching for these times in that, because I just never really got distracted, honestly. I kept following a golden thread. And maybe it was because someone said to me, you know, as much as they said, you know, you're a troubled youth, they also said to me, you're special. You're a leader. You know, I heard those words. They were around me. As much as I did hear the other, you're like trouble. But I heard that. And so I followed the clues. I followed the breadcrumbs that led me to many, many amazing things. And of course, it wasn't until my mid-20s, actually, that I began the path of really awakening to my body, which grew out of an initiation I had at the birth of my firstborn, which I'll just briefly speak about. Mariah was born in a garage in Santa Cruz, California, and I had a very fast delivery and then a very, very, very serious hemorrhage that, you know, got the ambulance, the fire department, everybody there. And during that experience, I had a very overt out of the body experience and definitely nearly died. But I had, because I had been to India, because I had some kind of a opening to something bigger than myself, I was able to really call for help to the mother and have, you know, what was ultimately written up as a pretty unique experience. I was able to have my uterus close, my uterus clamp shut, and my hemorrhaging stop without me having to go to the hospital. So there's a lot of sort of medical details, which I don't think this is the context for talking about, but it was just pure grace. And it was total surrender. And it was a life and death moment that woke me up to the fact that I knew how to open, and I knew how to open due to trauma, but I didn't really know how to close. And so I set out to figure out, how does that happen? What happened here? And that was before we understood the history of sexual abuse and birth as we do now, which is so obvious. But and so I had to do some really deep healing and began to really place myself at the feet of anybody who could give me a clue about how do I come home to this body. So it had started off as like my body as a place of service. Well, actually, it started off as my body as a place of violation. And then it grew to, well, you know, almost like the sacred wound, like here's this body to serve the other. And I did that and began to grow my work with education. But then it was really like, no, I have this child. I've got to rewrite the story of this lineage, and I want to heal. And I was blessed. My hunger was so deep. I was blessed to come to amazing teachers and teachings and begin really healing from the inside out.
Wonderful. And just to kind of contextualize that a little bit for our listeners, you know, one of the ways, the main way that I know you is through Movement Mass, which is, I don't know, maybe you could just briefly describe what is Movement Mass in your words.
Thank you. Well, the dance in general, and I'm schooled in the lineage of Gabrielle Roth. I'm first generation teacher of that work, which was a profound blessing to come into that work in my mid-20s. The dance throughout all time and all cultures has always been a way to come together in community or even come into communion alone. But the dance has always been a way to both journey deep inside to access the wounds and one's greatest intelligence, sort of both, and the interface between the two. But dance has also been a way to come into connection with something greater than ourselves, because the mind, for many of us, settles down in a well-orchestrated experience. The heart will inevitably open, and we find that ground in our being and can have an experience of the divine. So the dance is both a way for inner excavation and exploration, for deep and profound contemplation, and also for a connection, not just with something outside and bigger than ourselves, but the spaces between us. It's a very profound way for social engagement. So Movement Mass is one of the ways that my work unfolds in the world. And every Sunday in this community, we gather, and most of the time it's me or my apprentice leaders who are now really becoming solid colleagues, many of whom started with me as teenagers. We come and we guide our community through a process that brings them home to their bodies and to what is happening. And I often work with not only what's happening in the normal, healthy developmental process for a human being, but also what is happening in our city, what's happening in our nation, what's happening around the world, so that the work has a certain kind of relevancy. And the beautiful thing about dancing in a deep way is that the soul really does begin to come online.
Yes.
And we all need some relief. We need relief from the stories that we're hearing and seeing and experiencing day in and day out. And the soul is so visionary. The soul is so wise. And we need a time to come. And as temple or church or mosque has always been, a time to come into contemplation, to remember the bigger story of what we're all doing here, and not to get stuck in these small boxes that our world, as we know it, can cause us to be imprisoned in.
Yes. Yes. And I wonder, or I imagine perhaps a listener who has never experienced something like Movement Mass thinking, you know, I've danced, I've been to clubs or something like that. That didn't connect me with my soul. You know, what is the difference between the way that many people experience dance or movement in that way and Movement Mass? Because it's clearly different. When I go, I experience exactly what
you're saying. At a very fundamental level, I'm working often, but not always, with maps developed that really are here to help us understand the journey home to ourselves. The Five Rhythms, a beautiful body of work developed by Gabrielle Roth. That is one of the templates that helps me organize where we go and how we go through the 1 hour of moving together. I also weave in principles and practices that come from the field of somatic education and psychology that really have taught us how to restitch the fabric of our beings and connect our bodies and our hearts and our minds together. So I'm utilizing these principles to guide me as to how I then use my voice and the music and the energy to guide the group. And quite honestly, the intention I set is very strong. Mm. And then I come together with 120, 25 people who share some version of that intelligence. Yeah. I mean, there's always those people who go, what are we doing here? But everybody comes for to cultivate that inner space and that outer aha or ah and ah. Mm. And so that powerful intention is there. Plus, and this is really for all of us, whether we're working in the world of technology, in education, in politics, in science and medicine, I bring with me the work that I have done within myself so that as I show up in the room, there's an availability that I have for something greater to move through me, and my body and my voice become amplifiers for that energy. So in other words, I'm not preaching from a disconnected place. And I don't really call myself a preacher, but the word comes through me, you know, something is coming through me that is that sweet space, that sweet interface between my own biography and the soul of these times and something beyond all time. Just call it whatever you want. Mm. Spirit.
And that's so palpable for me there. It's just so touching and so transformative. And I one other kind of aspect of this that I'm so curious about your perspective on is the kind of intersection between dancing and movement in this way and trauma work. Like, what is going on there? Because I often experience myself accessing parts of my body that I've hidden from, like maybe for the week or for the month or for my whole life. And then it comes up, you know, in an hour of dance. And it gets processed and I cry, you know, and what's going on there?
That's beautiful. So first of all, I've been in a lot of dance environments, including conscious dance, a man named Mark Metz sort of developed or named for sort of this whole field of transformational dance. I've been in a lot of those environments and it hasn't always been healing and integrative. So again, intention is important. Plus, I also have a very keen and committed eye and understanding of how trauma unwinds and re-regulates. Now, I say that with a lot of humility because everybody is different. And in a room of 150 people or 120, whatever it is, not everybody has enough inner resource for the experience we're providing to really, really work. But I try to move slowly. I try to help people resource before going deeper or more intensely into sound and movement so that as things get activated, if they're going to, only that which is ready to integrate shows up. So we don't go from 0 to 60 we go slowly. We keep checking in. We find our resources so that we have that point of reference when places of disassociation or fragmentation show up. Very intentionally, I am through the body parts and through many different other things that we do there, trying to invite individuals to mobilize, to access and mobilize frozen parts, parts that they have separated themselves from. Parts that habitually have ways of moving that are no longer productive, but that may have saved their lives in the past. Gestures of fight, for example. So I'm really almost scientifically, but with a great deal of intuition and artistry, going in and helping people unearth the soils of their body, of their being, so that the breath and the music and the community can like fertilize it and health can be restored. And the rhythms themselves, although that was not necessarily understood at the beginning, these beautiful five rhythms actually work with some of the key principles that Peter Levine articulated about how trauma resolves itself. And if we look into nature, when animals are in a state of distress, they often will run and try and escape that or fight. But eventually, if they're not able to, they'll move into a state of immobility where it looks like they're dead. And as they come out of that, once they sense that they are safe, they'll start shaking and shake and shake and shake because they take all that adrenaline that it took to that, the, you know, when they were afraid that arose in their body, just like all of us as humans, that gets frozen in the body and it has to release. And so many of us have had frights, small ones, huge ones, that we never were able to explore and express and move on from. And that's just getting worse on the planet. Absolutely. And in some ways, fear has been intravenously fed into our systems. So to have the opportunity week by week to come in and actually just unwind that with in a space that has the capacity to support people if they get stuck or overwhelmed along the way is really key. And I at this point have an incredible team, most of whom grew up in my work, but not all, of somatic practitioners who are in that room with me, one or two others, who are just reading the room with me and noticing. You can almost see when a whole room's in a pattern of movement, where somebody who is disconnected or struggling or overwhelmed or shut down or acting out one way or another, not because they're malicious, but just because they're struggling or suffering or trying to figure themselves out, where that is. And so we very, hopefully, usually very gently and ideally skillfully, just come into proximity with that person to ally with them. And for some people, connection with other is a powerful way to help support the resolution of shock and trauma. For others, it can be activating. So there's, you know, there's, again, art and science involved in all that. So dance can actually cause the recapitulation of trauma, where you're just looping around in the same pattern again and again and again. And for many years, actually, that was some of my experience until I started to understand how to actually track my sensations in my body, not just move my body around in sort of big cathartic ways. So dance can be, it can support profound transformation and healing. But until we have the right resources, which can be internal or external, we can also get ourselves, you know, sort of like a record, deeper in a groove that doesn't move us forward at all.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, this feels like a good time to sort of leap out of the level of the individual and into the level of the collective. And, you know, one thing that I think you do so beautifully, and it's so inspiring, is sort of link the work that you've been talking about in Movement Mass to the kind of collective renewal of the planet and the transformation of the planet. And I'd love you to talk more about how you see that kind of metaphorical or fractal relationship between those two movements.
Well, okay. First of all, let's start with each of us individually. At some level, that's the sacred land that I have to regenerate right here in my own body. And, you know, as you know, this past year, I went through a very serious diagnosis of ovarian cancer. And here we are chatting it up literally 1 year later. And my body is so healthy. So, I mean, really healthy. And I went through surgery and chemo and the whole thing, the full descent. So I feel like by doing my own work, by inviting my students and the people around me to transform whatever is showing up in their systems, we are opening a corridor for all those who may have a similar situation unfolding in their lives. We're opening a corridor of healing that optimally will reverberate out and breed hope, if not cultivate really precise information about how healing can happen through whatever it is. So we start with the personal, and I take that really seriously. Obviously, I don't think I would have done so well this year had I not had decades of really pretty deep challenge, honestly, wild initiations, which we didn't really go any further past my 21st year, but it didn't stop with that intensity, quite honestly. But you got a wind of last year's. So we have to do our own work. And I think that allows us to, like I said, be a force for healing, be an agent of change, and stand in the gifts that we have for the world. And I really believe that those of us that have been given access to education, access to the kinds of healing options that we have in a community like Boulder, Colorado, access to information, that we have a responsibility to utilize it so that we can become all that the Great Spirit, the Divine, dreamt us to be. And because we know so many people do not have that kind of choice, that kind of opportunity. So those of us that do, if we can actually find our true potency, our true medicine, and bring it to this world, which is not an overnight process, as I said at the beginning, I feel like we can create a collective wave. And I think we are across this planet of goodness, of truth, of beauty, of resilience, of regeneration, of hope. And so that in of itself to me is some of the principles underlying what we're doing there. But there's a whole other piece or a couple of other pieces. One is we work really deeply with diverse communities around the world. And I don't know, Daniel, if you've ever been in the room in the summer when the young people from you know, refugee settlements and townships and college campuses and from all over the place come together in that room. And we enact what I call body-centered global rite of passage. And as people start to unwind the trauma in their own personal biography and start to see what they're carrying for their ancestry, they start to see the other who might have been like the other tribe that was responsible for the death of somebody in their family. They start to see the other not in a tribal way, but in a current time way, not in a reptilian way, but in a way that is grounded and open, and conversations can then begin at a whole other level. And in our work, we not only work with movement, but we work very deeply with other forms of art and the arts of both the body and the heart. And so we have found ways to work with Marshall Rosenberg's beautiful maps of nonviolent communications and counsel, all from a somatic space, so that when it's time to come out of the self and turn towards the other, we are freer and more grounded. And we also have tools for communication that allow us to build bridges rather than replicate violence and violation. So the dance becomes a place where we can do this cross-cultural, cross-gender, cross-race, cross-class conversations that need to be had. And we actually kind of do it. And obviously, it's just a teeny, teeny fractal. But I believe that once one of us builds a bridge across these divides, again, a corridor, a door is open, a channel can then be infused with more and more energy. And who knows where it leads? I mean, hopefully to things very different than what we outwardly see on the planet right now. But you and I both know that there is so much goodness happening, so much bridging happening at this time. And I feel that some of that, a little teeny piece, happens on our dance floors and through our programs. And now this network of young leaders who've all, you know, like I said, some started in their teens. Now they're in their 30s and 40s. They work together. They love each other. They're in for the long haul with each other. They're raising children together. They're tracking each other's children across the globe. And who knows what comes of all that? So that's another way that I feel like our work really is personal and global. And then there's one more, but I'll take a breath here and just see if there's anything you want to say.
I'm just taking that in.
Thank you. Thank you.
I guess I wasn't aware of how deep the roots were with young people that had been going on that long that they were now having children. I mean, that is what the voice called you to do.
Yeah, it's true. It was, I think maybe two summers ago, I was up at a retreat center with maybe 70 really hardcore students. And I was like, I don't know. I was having a moment and everybody said, look, Melissa, you raised the children that will raise the children. And they were like, we got this. We have this, you know, let us lead. We got it. And I really feel that actually me going through cancer in the last year and choosing to still run our summer camps, really, I now have let go in a very important way so that these amazing, brilliant souls can really shine and do their magic on our stages, but around the world. And I feel very proud and excited because it's good for all of us. Because as we grow through decades and change over time, our missions change and mine is changing. Yeah, I want to say one more thing about Movement Mass because I think it's relevant to the conversation that you're hosting so generously with the world yourself, which is when a group of people come together and mobilize their energy with intention and focus. And in our case, it's prayer, but it could be anything. Great things can come of that. And so when we are feeling the horrific tragedy of what's unfolding in Puerto Rico on a given Sunday or in high schools or down the road or, you know, wherever, I feel that our love, it's subtle. It's not enough. But thank goodness we're igniting it. We're feeling our pain and moving into a place of warmth. So that we can amplify that out to the world that doesn't always have the opportunity to gather in safe spaces and pray and remember and come home to themselves and one another in such an integrative way. And movement really does help many of us get out of our minds and truly into that space of, you know, redemption and peace, really. So that's part of what we're up to there on those Sunday mornings.
Yeah, totally. And so you mentioned this word a couple of times, and that's initiation. And I know that to a certain degree, that's what your new book, Youth on Fire, is about. And I'm curious both if you could share a kind of, what you know, essentially what is initiation? And then maybe we can go back into some more of your initiations. You know, you mentioned we stopped when you were 21. What initiations were there after that for you?
Beautiful. Thanks, Daniel. Well, we're in a time where there's many ways that initiation's happening. Traditional cultures always understood about what we know as rites of passage, initiatory processes that intentionally guided an individual from one stage of life into another. And there were ceremonies, there were teachings, there were ways that olders and elders in the community had a responsibility to attend to the initiate as they were going through a rite of passage. Now, the one we all have some awareness of is that one from late childhood puberty into young adulthood. And obviously that's a lot in our culture. That's a big chunk of time from the, you know, the first change of a voice or the budding of a breast all the way to when one is like paying their bills and standing on their own legs and doing something meaningful in the world. There's a long journey in there. Yeah. But traditional cultures really understood what some of the key components were to help pass on the culture to the next generation. So Van Gennep, who's one of the great thinkers on this whole topic of rites of passage, Arnold van Gennep, spoke about three phases of a rite of passage: severance, where one has to leave and basically cut cords with, turn away from, release something in order to move into the second phase, that of the threshold experience, which is that period of I'm not in the old me and I'm not in the new me. I've left the safe shores or the ideally safe shores of childhood. I have stepped into the great waters of adolescence that are often turbulent. There's white water, there's rocks, you know, there's all sorts of things. And until we then cross those waters in the threshold experience and find our way onto the new shore and begin what Van Gennep said is called incorporation, where we essentially integrate or digest what happened for us through the rite of passage, through the threshold experience. So I work with that frame with everything I do, even a movement mass, because we really see that that cycling in our lovemaking. We see it in the birth of a child. We see it in a marriage or a divorce. We see it actually in the course of a day where, but I'm going to bring it back sort of out of the mundane into the sacred space. So traditional cultures really provided that for their people. And we, as you know, are so dislocated, and we have lost our connection with traditional ways of initiating our young, for example, or working with a, you know, the birth of a baby. Now, in many parts of the world, people have started to culturally create new cultures of initiation based on what they heard, the echoes of some of the more traditional initiatory rites, or what was arising out of the needs of their community and their own souls. So there are intentional rites of passage and initiatory processes really throughout the life cycle. There can be. And I've devoted my life to really developing those in meaningful ways that are both rooted in tradition and contemporary, meeting the needs of the of these times. There's also life crises initiations, which we're seeing all over the planet right now. And those are the ones where something happens. There's a sudden death. There's a flood. There's a, you know, a wicked... Right. Yeah, actually. But probably for you and I, that wasn't as much a life crisis, although it has threats of it, as it is for other populations in our nation and for sure there. But it definitely has the elements of it, for sure. So many of the elements. And we are in a threshold time on this planet, for sure, which is where things are in chaos. And a lot of the work I do is how do we find our ground?
Yeah.
How do we stay connected to our center? How do we build networks? How do we resource ourselves when everything is destabilizing so that we can land on our feet whenever, you know, the music stops? And of course, sometimes the music is horrific noise. So these life crises is a really critical phenomenon that I feel that the somatic work is really essential in helping humanity navigate through them. That's as long as there is safety. Without safety, there really isn't much choice. And that's a very real thing for millions and, you know, millions of people on this planet, the refugee community for one, and the immigrant community, unfortunately, right here. So there's life crises, there's intentional initiations, and then there's just even the seasonal cycles where we see it's a different kind of tracking, but there are these transitions where we learn about the release of one and the organic movement into the next with a significant change in between. And that's also dysregulated in these times, the seasonal changes that happen. So I could say more, but maybe there's a question you want to ask about that, my personal or just the collective.
Yeah, well, I would love to dive back into your personal kind of history of initiations, because I think it's fascinating. It's also demonstrative of what you've been talking about in a way that I think is really useful. So what came after, you know, your initiation that you were speaking about when you were 21?
Well, thank you, Daniel. One is like I said, I really went and found mentors and teachers. And my journey through the Five Rhythms work was absolutely initiatory, although it didn't have that as an overt intention. And some of the key elements of rites of passage were not necessarily embedded in it, at least not intentionally. But I certainly was turned inside out and reformed and became a much more of a soul-centric human being through years and years and years of really rigorous work through the dance with a mentor who was able to see me very deeply in the early years and serve that unfolding. So I had great teachers and I was a really committed student, and that's a huge piece of this. And I really attribute that to the fact that I was in a lot of pain and that I heard the wailing and the weeping of the people of the planet. It was just how I was and am wired, actually. And I had other mentors, incredible, Tamara Slayton, people you know, people you don't know. And then over the course of my life, I met divorce and had to navigate my way through that and really somehow feel the complete shredding of the ground of myself and my family's and find the through line, the dignity and the discipline to really move with and through this experience in such a way that we all came out more whole. Now, that was a long, deep, rigorous process, but that whole experience of having everything broken down and having to reform into something new was part of that experience, that death and that renewal.
And how long did that take for you? How long did that take, would you say?
I can't put time on that. I feel like I'm still working with it as my children do their own work around that. And I actually had two children with two different men, so I have a wild biography. And I had my own healing to do really around my own story of abuse, which was such an integral part of the repair that came through the dissolution of marriage. And I am profoundly, beautifully married at this point to a man who is absolutely, you know, a soulmate and a real match for who I am. But it took a good while for me to get healthy enough within myself to be able to really care for myself enough and like myself enough to actually attract someone who was able to mirror that back to me and who had the capacity to sit into the kind of depth and complexity that is my creative world, honestly. And so I feel very blessed with that. But that was a long journey, you know, really from my childhood till now. I feel like I've been on that journey of the repair of the disconnection between the masculine and feminine in my own biography. And along the way, I also had a very, very beautiful and deep relationship with a man who drowned, and I received him out of the ocean in my arms. And he and I, Steve Cannon, were leaders together in this community. So it wasn't just my utter and complete shattering, but it was his children's and our communities here in Boulder. Wow. And that happened around my 42nd year of life. And it was a huge initiation for us all, but in particular, for us all. And I learned a great deal about how to work with a community in shock through these arts of body, heart, and soul that I've been speaking about to help a community come through shock back into a place of deeper love and peace. And, you know, I was working with myself through this it was a big, big work and his beautiful family and our community who loved and loves Steve to this day. So that was a very significant initiatory process through a life crisis that I navigated through with a great deal of support and grace. And always, I think about, like so many times this has been the case, I'll say to the people around me when I was going through a divorce, I remember saying this to my children, or when I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, like, we got this. We're going to do this. Let's pay attention. I know we can do this. And having that faith and that vision of resurrection, that just that commitment to navigating through the complex and uncharted terrain of descent and return has really been important for me as I've gone through initiatory experiences, whether they were intentional ones or life crises. And I'm singing the good word on that for today. I'm feeling really grateful for that way of seeing it. And I think we have to take that into these times,
yes.
really,
yes.
which I know is one place we might, you wanted to talk about. I mean, none of us know what's going to happen here. And the environment is so challenged, and the social and environmental toxins, as my elder Paul Hill says, are so extreme, and we're all being affected in so many ways. And yet, I believe in grace. I believe in the resilience of the human spirit. I believe in our intelligence. And we have to act as if. You know, and Joanna Macy, I once heard say, maybe she says this a lot, you know, we don't know. We actually don't know how it's going to all turn out. But we certainly have to give everything we've got during this time of so much uncertainty. And as you say, actually, and also in this time of incredible collaborative brilliance mm-hmm. that we see in so many mm-hmm. ways. Just look at journalism in these times. I mean, who would have thought? And look how incredible the media is being in terms of protecting the truth right now and guarding it and guiding humanity towards it. So I am humble, like all of us have to be. And I know that, like you and I, we know where our next meal is going to be. We live with an incredible amount of comfort. We are still able to have a certain buffer between our lives and so much of the extraordinary suffering that's happening out there. And with that said, I know that there is already so much loss, so much unimaginable, unconscionable sacrifice that's never too many degrees away from any of us. And somehow I still have images of beauty and kindness and resilience in my consciousness, and I focus on that.
One piece I'm curious about exploring with you is the relationship between privilege and responsibility. You know, how should we approach this relationship in a way that isn't a soul crushing burden?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I sort of think if everybody showed up and did what they are capable of doing and leveraged their privilege, we'd be doing really well, actually.
Yeah.
Which means sharing our resources and utilizing what we have rather than counting on a few to do a lot. And there are a lot doing a lot right now. But I do feel that part of why I got sick was I was having, it wasn't soul crushing, but it was almost soul crushing. I was caring a lot in a way that wasn't sustainable. And I had to go through a really deep surrender around that. What I can say is it's really a moment-to-moment process, Daniel. Mm-hmm. We have to continue to be excavating the true call of our soul. And checking, is what I'm doing right now in alignment with that? And that can be, you know, cleaning up the garbage in a dumpster that fell over in the backyard of somebody else's backyard. I mean, it doesn't have to be just all the creative work that we like to engage in or the, you know, how we make our money. It's in every moment. And I like to believe that we have to take up what's right in front of us. And if that means, I have this thing, if the toilet paper roll is empty and you're there, it's your turn to change it. Period. Nobody else is going to do it. And I can't even tell you in like how often I see people just leave stuff behind, walk past, you know, a pile of trash, walk past something that really would take nothing for them to contribute to. And I've seen this again and again and again when it comes to working with children and other people's children, that we can be so busy protecting our youth or our resources or our time that we miss. One of my students calls it I'll let her speak to it. It's a beautiful, the abyss of miss. Sarita Rivard speaks to the abyss of miss. I think there's a lot of misses out there, but what I'd really rather focus on is how can we go to sleep at night tired? Not so tired that we can't get in the front door, but knowing that we've put in our share for the day. We've shown up for each conversation, for each whatever it is, how we're driving our car, how we're eating our food, how we're working with our resources, financial and energy and otherwise. Yeah. And, you know, most people don't die from showing up and giving what they got. We just don't.
But yet we're afraid of it on some level. Like I know I am, right? What I mean, so there's something there that I'd love to hear you speak on. Like I come to Movement Mass and there's a part of me that feels inflamed that often I spend the rest of the week running away from. And it's this sense of responsibility or mutual accountability or interconnection. And it's scary to feel responsible. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I know it's true what you say. It won't kill us to throw ourselves into our lives and responsibility, but there's a part of me that feels like it will, you know? What is that?
Well, I don't know exactly what that is, except I have some thoughts. One is, so many of us are spending our time doing things we know is not what we're really supposed to be doing because the culture did not reflect back to us educational opportunities and professional doorways that made sense to our souls. So sure, nobody wants to throw themselves into a job that's promoting something they don't value or not really utilizing who they are and how they are. So I feel like when we start to really feel that keen, yes, this is what I'm here to do, there's a little more of a enthusiasm of the spirit, wildness that we can bring to what it is that we're doing. That's one thing. The other thing is, if we have not been initiated, if we have not had olders and elders look at us and say, I see you, what you're doing is good, needed, thank you. It's really hard to go out there and do it. And I mean, you may say, I don't believe you, Melissa, but I have my own incredible moments of insecurity. And is it enough? And is it okay? And how was that really? And, you know, something happened for me in the last year of my life where I just like, I don't have time to give that part of my brain any more attention. This is who I am. This is what I got. Mm. And it's more than enough, you know? But I think of all the ways we've wasted energy of like, am I pretty enough? Am I saying the right thing? You know, will my impact be just enough, not too much? And it's tragic actually. And we need our olders and our elders to look us in the eye and say, thank you. And I sought that out actually, because I didn't have it in a good way during much of my young adulthood and my early career. And it takes a true elder to be able to do that and to understand that the next generation's work is critical and that we have to bless it. So I think that's missing. And then I'm just like, just let me think about this for a minute with you. Mm-hmm. I think we still live in an incredibly, capitalistic mindset that is fueled by competition and judged upon how much rather than the quality of. And we're all needing to make that shift. And as we do that, we can start to value what we do and realize, you know, the whole triple bottom line idea. It's not just how much money we make, but how is it socially impacting the field and how is it serving the environment or not? And so I think as we all slip out of sort of that paradigm of comparison, I think it'll make it easier for us just to get up and be who we are. You know, like this beautiful crocus that's budding out there, you know, it's just like, hey, it feels like spring. I'm going to just come popping up now and be myself.
Yeah.
And it's just doing it. Mm-hmm. So I can't wait to learn more about your work and to actually really see you and support you, because I felt that the questions you had posed for this conversation were so deep and profound. And I just was like, who is this human? I want to know him. And I do want to see your work go where it's meant to go, because I can feel the integrity of your soul and your aspiration for making a true difference. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Melissa. It's wonderful to hear that from you, because you're somebody that is so inspiring to me. And, you know, part of that, I mean, I can even feel that what you said, like having you, somebody I respect as an elder, saying that to me, like my energy just increases in that moment. You know, there is something true about that. It feels true even in this moment. And I guess the kind of space I want to end this conversation on is just, so we've talked about the importance of initiation, the importance of relationship to elders, young people, people of all ages, who are searching for meaning, maybe see the importance or are hearing us say these words, but don't feel they have access to that resource. What do we say to them? How do we help them? How do we support them?
Well, thank you. I feel like we create environments where the conversations can happen. That's really important. Be it in a church, in a temple, be it in a mosque, be it out on the path, you know, just gather people and set up the conversations. And in my book, I actually talk about how we have elder evenings and we create councils and world cafes, and we host really difficult conversations. And we do that year after year to eventually relationships get formed that have become, now some of the youngers work with the olders or the elders, and they run organizations together. I mean, things happen. Right. So that's one thing. The other is I have a responsibility, and I feel like I've really been a bit on that, is getting the elders to come on out and show up and come as you are. We need you. And valuing their presence. And as I get older, I can see how this society, unlike others, does discard our elders or our olders. And the difference between an older and an elder is you can put a lot of years under your belt. But if you have lived your personal inner life and your interpersonal life and your professional and spiritual life with a vigor and an integrity, there is something that happens that causes one to become elder. And there's a lot of people who are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, who really don't, 90s, who maybe don't make it to elder, just are living an uninspired existence as older. So the young people have the responsibility to like go, knock, knock, who's there? I need you. What do you think about this? What are you doing with your life? Hey, come on and let's work on this together. And to ask and to serve, show up. I mean, for years when I was much, much younger, I'd bring children to, you know, senior citizens' homes and to places and just go sit at the feet of people who are not in your generation, who would love to tell you their initiation stories, who want to hear about the struggles of today, who'd love to do some art with you or dream whatever or laugh about not much, you know? And I just feel like it's young people's job to not look away, but to invite. And it's old people's jobs to not hide away, but to invite. And who knows what can happen. And I'm really not into drive-by moments between olders and youngers, elders and youth. I'm into let's keep rhythmically finding each other. You know, let's have moments where we keep seeing each other so that we can cultivate real relationship that nourishes us deeply. And So I really think it's a key component to getting through these times is gathering.
Yeah, just in hearing you speak on behalf of that, it brought chills to my body and tears to my eyes, actually. I mean, I never had that growing up. You know, I never had that kind of relationship with olders or elders. And I've had to recreate that for myself in different ways, intentionally. And it's been a real challenge, you know? And I feel the tragedy of that loss in our culture and in my life. And I yeah, it's just, there's a lot of work to be done.
That's right. That's so true. And I really respect that you are letting yourself just feel that loss, because that's the first step to actually changing the situation for yourself and your peers in the world. You know, you're not trying to run past it. You're just like, oh my goodness, what a huge miss. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for bringing your energy and thank you for all the work you've done. I mean, for me, you know, I've known you as somebody who is an inspiring presence in my life, but to do the research I did for this conversation is just, you are an exemplar of awakened service and service for the well-being of life on this planet. And I just so deeply appreciate you and the work that you've done and the organizations that you've created and the human beings, the children that are now adults who are teaching the next generation of children who will teach the next generation of children. It's so beautiful. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Daniel. And I look forward to being with you offline and continuing our conversation and just blessings with all your good work. And thank you for seeing me. Thank you for taking time and taking interest in actually really seeing beyond just what we do in that one short hour a week.
Oh, we're gonna get some. 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 Oh, we're gonna get some.